Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds Family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Friesian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is moving like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough! Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back after a really almost an hour conversation with Daniel Sir and Peter Eckebert, representing the National HPPA legally in the challenges to HISA, and Dick Powell joined us as well. Right now, and I can assign the name challenge to Eric Hamelbeck misspelling Maria's name. So it's completely, and it just shows you, it doesn't take much. It doesn't take much to to throw off a name. And listen, as somebody who has whose name doesn't really have a vowel, I can certainly appreciate Maria's. I'm not the first person to butcher it, right?
No, absolutely not. It's been a lifelong thing.
Maria Catignani.
Yes.
There we go.
Mine is low, which is very easy. And I don't own lumber stores unless I need a reservation at a fancy restaurant in Naples, Florida. It works every time. Low like lumber. Oh, a French restaurant. I couldn't get in for four tries. The lady said, "You own Lowe's?" I said, "It's spelled the same." She said, "I love your store. Come have dinner on me." It happened to me 7 years ago. I got a whole bottle of port, free wine.
Oh, that.
I tried to tell her I don't own it. She said, "Oh, I love your store."
That's great.
I could do a good French accent.
That's great. So well,
that works.
You'd have to be from Kannapolis, North Carolina, to have some relation to Lowe's. And I only know that because my first job out of college was with Cannon Mills in Kannapolis, the textile firm, and that they got to spend quite a bit of time actually.
I'm just Ken Lowe from Shepherdstown.
I love it. Well, Maria is the former director of the Charlestown HBPA. And
still is. I'm the executive
something
director.
Are you outgoing? Or, okay,
No. You know what? I was at Mountaineer Park for about 3 years, and I came down to Charlestown in 2011, and I've been there ever since.
Okay. All right, because, again, Eric said ex-director. Eric botched
you know
this up
something
pretty
we don't
No, that's ex as an executive director.
Oh, executive director. Look at that. So we do. All right, good point.
It's not Eric, it's your English. I mean, it's your change your glasses. Go ahead.
Chairman of, and Ken is the chairman of the West Virginia Racing Commission.
Used to be president of the HBPA in Charlestown when Marie came on board.
How about that?
So I hired her, and they're firing you, evidently. I didn't know that.
No, they're not firing me.
I know that.
It's a community that of long standing, and Charlestown in particular, and of course, not to take away from West Virginia, but Charlestown in particular has had just a litany of great horsemen, many of which who've moved into the Maryland circuit and the Mid-Atlantic circuit, and the Dutch Rose, Ferris Allen, and others. The ones that basically live and work and spend their whole life in West Virginia make it go, and the parade of untimely passings has been... and you've added a couple of other names that have made it just an awful 6 months, 9 months?
Actually, a year.
A year?
We have three big families that have been advocates and powerhouses for West Virginia racing and breeding between the Funkhauser, Casey and McKee families. They were the foundation of what we have as the breeding program in West Virginia. And to their credit, they also were significant in the training. Randy not so much, but John McKee and Jim Casey were significant to the training end of things. Randy, of course, with the Sullivan Farms, Mr. Casey with Taylor Mountain Farm, and John McKee with Bow Ridge Farm. And it's, the history is that John McKee has been in the business since 1969. Mr. Casey had his farm, Taylor Mountain Farm, since the year 2000, but he'd been in racing since the early 60s. And Randy's family goes back to his grandfather, I think in the early 30s, R.J. Funkhauser, his grandfather, and then Randy's mother, Ruth, was involved.
John McKee, 1,300 wins.
Mm-hmm.
And on the breeding side, for those that watch the stake results, and I for years have put up the weekend stakes, and there's so many great West Virginia Knights, stake programs,
right.
And you would see Fibersond, the surviving son of Stormcat that has been a sensation. I mean, right. there were nights there'd be seven stakes and Fibersond would have sired five or six winners.
Right. Actually, they just had the Breeders' Awards this
Sunday.
Weekend on
Sunday,
and of course John was Bow Ridge Farm was the leading breeder.
8 out of 12 awards went to the farm, to John and to Cindy, who's carrying on.
Yeah.
Talk about the Caseys, father and son, and for those that saw the... two days ago?
A tragic situation.
Thursday.
Mr. Casey passed away January 8th, and unexpectedly, John passed away last week. John was going to be... who carried on, the Taylor Mountain business, and now there's some, not just with Taylor Mountain Farm, but now with our industry and all the things that have happened, there's some uncertainty as to where we go and what our next steps are. And I think it's a real opportunity for us to be innovative and try to find new ways to make that program be as successful as it's been all these years. Of course, the Funkhauser family has, they have two sons, John and Joe, who can carry on the racing and breeding tradition. And, you know, like I said, I just feel like this is an opportunity. It's sad, and, you know, it's a sad situation, but it's an opportunity where we have to be innovative about how we're going to improve the racing and breeding program in West Virginia, especially increasing the foal crop.
The Jim Casey, John, I don't think John was ever on the show, but Jim came, Russell Road, right. Who was just unbelievable.
Right. So Mr. Casey had, including Russell Road, who I think had two breeders, actually won the Breeders' Classics twice.
Yeah.
Mr. Casey had nine, I think, Breeders' Classics win in terms of the actual race, and then I think about 35 or 40 horses that won on the night of the Breeders' Classics in some form or other. So he's been, you know, in terms of training, Mr. Casey has been prolific as well as breeding.
If I might add, not to take away from what your main topic is, but these were the same gentlemen, people, and their families that were so crucial when the rules, when the programs were being substantially supported in the legislature. It was the John McKees and those guys mm-hmm. that would go to Charleston. Our state's very big geographically. It's 309 miles. I've done it 30 million times, as Maria has too, mm-hmm. to get to the Capitol from where we live. But they would go week after week after week to get the story told about why the Breeders' Program had needed to be as strong as it was. And they deserve so much credit for that.
And to his point, I don't want to miss out on talking about Sam Huff. Sam Huff passed away in the last, little bit more than a year ago. Sam Huff, who was he and his partner Carol Holden were the ones who created the West Virginia Breeders Classics. And, you know, that's another huge program and another huge, he was a huge influence and very significant in the legislature, actually, and very helpful.
And he should be on that same list of great persons who's passed. And Carol's there to take his place and runs the program. She was actually the one who ran it. It was Sam's idea, and they've told us. I spoke at Sam's funeral, and he was a real stalwart. But he had the name recognition when he went into Charleston. The Charlestown people didn't. They established themselves. And Sam was, in fact, I made the statement at a ceremony, Sam Huff, Sam and Carol saved racing, horse racing in West Virginia. They saved it first.
Sam Huff was he loved the game so much, and he would show up. We'd see him in Saratoga. We would see him
everywhere.
Anywhere there was a big day, and you know, had a handful of nice, you know, he had, you know, nice horses, and he just took such pleasure in any, you know, a win at any level.
And the first time I ever met him, he gave me heck for having a Clarion Hotel instead of a Marriott, and he scared me to death. He was my hero as a kid. Second time I met him, he told me if I didn't lose weight, that damn gut, you're going to die, boy. And don't wear the $200 shoes, they'll ruin your feet. And I'm thinking, my God, what did I do to this man? I like him. We were friends from that point forward. But with Sam, you knew where you stood. I can imagine him on the football field, and I remember the CBS thing about the violent world of Sam. Sam was that way. He was raised in a mining camp. He'd knock your block off. He'd tell you first that he'd knock it off. That's what he did. He did that to me, but it toughened me when I came back to him. And we worked together from that point forward.
I love it.
Carol deserves a lot of credit for doing what she's doing.
You also mentioned Dennis.
Dennis Bybee.
Dennis Bybee. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Bybee had Bybee Road Farm.
Right.
And to my knowledge, he was relatively new in the scene, but that's, like, to me, relatively new, maybe 10 years. You know, that's
he was more of a quiet individual.
Right. He really was. And he was just coming into his own. He was all excited. He had a lot of energy. He had a lot of drive and determination. And he wasn't sick even. I believe he fell. But if he had not, you know, he'd still be out there plugging away.
I'd classify him as a thinker. He was a thinker, a quiet talker. where some of these other guys, particularly Sam, were out there leading the charge, not to take away from Dennis, because Dennis thought about stuff. But he could talk one-on-one and reason with you, where the other two or others were more likely to stand up in front of a crowd. And this is what we ought to
right,
do.
And but all of them incredible advocates for racing and breeding and just wanted to see West Virginia grow and thrive.
And every one of them, it wasn't just these individuals. It was their families that were involved, whether it's the wives or the sons, whomever. It takes all of that to make it work. And then at the risk of saying, their crowd will follow you if they believe your story, if they can trust you, as you were talking about in the previous conversation. By the way, West Virginia is one of only two states. That, you can talk about that later, because that's us.
Yeah.
Okay, later.
Well, no, you can, I mean, if you want to.
Well, let's not interrupt this now.
All right, that's fair. That's fair. When you fold in some of the earlier passings, I mean, beside the ones that caught my eye in just the last 2 weeks, in terms of John McKee and then John Casey, but I didn't even I somehow missed Jim passing. Right. January 8th. Wow, unbelievable! And Randy Funkhauser.
And there is another son. There's Jimmy.
Yeah.
Who is a vet in Maryland.
Right.
And he's talking about maybe coming back and talking about working with Christy, the wife of John, perhaps,
yeah,
to keep the operation going in some way, shape, or form.
I think that everything is so new, and the shock is just so much that there's a lot to be, a lot to be worked out. And I don't think they got over the whole passing of Jim Casey.
Right.
They hadn't had time to work that out, and now it's a double whammy.
And John has a 15-year-old son named Alan.
Yeah.
Who's very much involved, I understand.
Right. And of course, John's partner, Christy, is a trainer. She's been pitching in to help with the breeding. It's just a lot right now. We're going through a lot right now.
And John McKee's wife, Cindy, the funeral, as we said, is today. And she's going through all that, but she's vowed to stay in the business, probably, I'm not speaking for her, but probably downsize. But she plans on, she's been in all her life. So she'll be there. She'll get by. She's a fighter.
Cindy's daddy was actually the track man, the
track superintendent.
Track superintendent at Charlestown years ago. So she's been in the business a long time, too. Yeah. There's in Charlestown, because we have year-round racing,
yeah.
It is very much of a generational thing. And, that's what it is with all these people, with John McKee and Cindy, with the Funkhausers, with the Caseys. It's very generational.
And the Charlestown track originated in 1933. That was in December as well.
It's got one of the great histories, of the 20th century.
And 200 years prior to that, guess who was racing horses down Washington Street in Charlestown? George Washington's family. And they built 7 homes, 6 of which still stand in that county. Probably because George Washington was an advocate of moving the state capital further, the nation's capital further inland, because of fear of invasion. And they had picked 5 spots on the Potomac River. One of the spots they chose was across the river from Shepherdstown, where Ferry Hill sits, the government operation building today. And I've been told, I've not seen the drawing, that the drawing of the Capitol on that hill was to be 2 buildings, with the Senate on the Maryland side and the House on the other side. I can't find that drawing. If anybody out there knows where I can find a copy, please get me one.
Wow.
That was at Shepherdstown, which was then called Mecklenburg. But Washington wanted it there. I was told, in what I've read in history, shared with me, that the 2 people responsible for submitting the proposal from the Shepherdstown and Sharpsburg community were late delivering it. Therefore, Shepherdstown, Mecklenburg was not considered. But Washington already committed to Lord Fairfax, had the 1,000 acres in Charlestown, and his family moved there and built the houses.
Wow.
The town is named for his youngest brother, Charles, and there were 97 lots, and they put them on a piece of paper, and I can tell you where the offices they sold those lots out of. And the main street was Mildred, or Washington. All the original streets were family member names. It was Charlestown. In the 4 corners of
that's
340
tremendous.
And Route 9, the town got 2 corners. That's where the town hall's on one corner. Diagonally across the street is the commercial property where the restaurants are now. On the other corner is the courthouse where John Brown was tried and found guilty. And on the opposite corner is the first rural free delivery post office that they gave to the United States government so their mail could be delivered to the Washington homes. That's in Charlestown.
You have to come and visit us.
Oh, I've been. I've been.
And I'll give you three. I'll take you on Gilligan's three-hour tour. But I'll get you back. Or the half an hour tour, whichever one you want.
Well, the thing that was amazing to me, I was on my way to Derby and came for the Classic night.
For the Breeders' Classic.
And in April. No,
the Charlestown Classic.
Yeah. And what was amazing, it's a night, so it's 10:30, whatever time so I ended up heading back to get, because I was going to have to get to Louisville the next day. And I woke up on the Maryland side. I picked a little hotel, I think I'm right across the border. And I woke up and realized I was at Antietam. And there was no way I wasn't touring Antietam, just myself, just driving. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievably moving, and I cannot stress that if anybody goes to Charlestown, you've got to.
30,000 men lost their lives.
So the whole you drive around at the various points, and you just can't believe what's. What each station and each little skirmish and battle and I understand is it on what night is it? Is it Halloween that they light those
luminary? No, it's near the end of the year. It's in December.
It's in December.
And there are 30,000 candles put out.
They say it's lit. It'll just
moving.
And if we're talking history, we have to throw the steamboat in Shepherdstown, which was in Mecklenburg. The steamboat was invented in Mecklenburg by James Rumsey. And Washington Jefferson viewed it one time, the boat itself, not in the water. But Rumsey doesn't get all the credit that he deserved because a set of his plans were stolen out of his residence in Shepherdstown that he left behind while he was sent to meet the man in Ben Franklin in letters of recognition and recommendation from Washington and Jefferson. He went to Philadelphia, got on the train to Sharpsburg, and he went to Philadelphia, and the first Rumsey Society was started, and he showed Franklin his plans, and Franklin wrote him a letter of recommendation, which they did, and he went to England to make his presentation at the Queen's Scientific Committee. He made a brilliant presentation. It was very well accepted. He went back to his room, and he had an aneurysm, and he died that night. And
oh
they buried
God.
In Westminster. In the he's buried over there in the West Abbey Chapel graveyard.
Got to work on a movie with this.
There's a better one. When Mary Tyler Moore, how much time have we got? Mary Tyler Moore's great-great-great-grandfather, George Schindler, who was a brasssmith, came to Mecklenburg on a barge up the canal, and he built a house on the corner of Church and German Street that still stands. It's a brick house. And he was a brasssmith, but the house was only owned by three individuals, a church, and a person. And when he died, we were able to notify Mary Tyler Moore, who I knew as Laura Petrie, and she came to town as the commencement speaker for Shepherd College. I happened to be the Stanley alumnus that year, so I got to spend some time with her. I kept calling her Laura. She kept saying, Ken, I'm not Laura. Please don't call me Laura. I said, I'm sorry. I encouraged her to talk to her friends in Hollywood, such as Steven Spielberg. The real movie in Shepherdstown is about the Battle of Shepherdstown, which is the day after Antietam, September the 18th, when a regiment of young blacks from New York on their shiny horses and soldiers with no military experience were sent by McClellan, who could have ended the war that day, to chase Johnny Reb back to Virginia. So they came over the Potomac River, and there's paintings of Lee on his horse Traveler as the last troops go through. There was who left. And on the top of the hill, they put 20 riflemen and two cannon, Lee did, saying only discourage them if they're coming to end the war. Don't let them get across. But they didn't know it was a young group of inexperienced riders having fun. I took a class on it years ago. And as they came across, the messenger was sent to tell General Lee, it's okay, it's going to be okay. The messenger gave them the wrong story and said, they're coming to finish you off, sir. So he got Stonewall Jackson, anybody that could shoot a gun, go back, and they killed all those young blacks but one. It's a terrible story. But the southern town of Shepherdstown felt bad for the young blacks. And there was a sympathy there, because Shepherdstown was pro-South. That was the South. Maryland was the North. But because of the tragedy, they saw the other side. Never should have happened. McClellan screwed up again.
You know,
that takes us to Heisen. Speaking of squirrels, no, we'll feed that one on later on. I get emotional because I'm from there.
No, I love that. Clearly, anybody that's coming to Charlestown has an appreciation for history. I should introduce you to Ed Fontaine, who was a huge Civil War.
Okay.
Ed has toured. He's retired now from the New York Post, but Ed has toured all over.
Tell him to come to Sherbert. I'll give you my card and you can call me.
Outstanding. Wow. This was important to be able to pay tribute, and you've added, you added three more names to the Caseys, to Jim and John Casey and John McKee, Randy Funkhauser and Dennis Bybee and Sam Huff. A tough stretch for Charlestown and for West Virginia racing, but an important part of the game, and we can talk some of the legalities that you're involved in as well. But I appreciate this, Ken Lowe, and Maria Catagnani, and thank you.
Let me add one more thing, and as Maria knows well, West Virginia is one of the best, if not the finest, breeders program, we think, in the country. Because of those gentlemen and others that had occurred. But it continues this day and have some of the highest purses in the country. And that's because of simulcast wagering for the most part. But it's all a great process. We work together. We've had some ups and downs in different directions. This is a big down, but we'll come back. We'll be there. We'll be there. We'll make it.
Best of luck. I'm delighted that we had this opportunity to pay tribute properly to the McKees, the Caseys, the Funkhausers, and
Sam Huff
and Dennis Bybee. Thank you.
We appreciate you. Thank you.
Not at all. There we go. Maria Catagnani and Ken Lowe. Dr. Doug Daniels is going to jump in here. And now that some of the early, thank you, some of the early kickoff to the HBPA convention, Dr. Daniels' responsibility. There we go. Yeah, that'd be good if you do that. Yeah, beautiful. All right. First kind of quiet moment here this morning that we've had. Dr. Daniels, good morning.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
We spent the first hour this morning having a in-depth probing of where things stand on the legal challenge. Peter Eckebert and Daniel Sir were with us, plus Dick Powell. And, obviously, Dr. Daniels, your responsibilities as National HBPA president go beyond the HISA challenge. I mean, Eric's been the point man a pinata for opponents and for for people that don't see the initiative for what it is, but you've got a wider array of topics and responsibilities that you've got to keep tabs on and have all the constituents talk a little bit about your role. I know there's an election coming, and I think it's pretty much accepted that you'll be reelected. Talk a little bit, since we visited last, about your role and your thoughts on HBPA's position right now in the game.
Thanks for asking me. I am, those gentlemen that you just mentioned, they clearly do all the heavy lifting, and I appreciate what they do, and I don't know how Eric keeps up with all of it, truly. He's always doing something, and I'm sure it's hard on him personally and hard on his personal life and family life, too. And you're right, being the pinata is not a coveted position by far. The added position I took up here recently was on the Horsemen's Advisory Group. It was a late addition. I'm happy to do it. And I've tried to make it well known to all the other members of the group that I try and not come in there with a constituency in mind, but I'm come in there as Doug Daniels, veterinarian and horse owner, and knowing that I do have concerns about HISA in general and its implementation and going forward, and there are still plenty of unknowns, and I feel like I feel like when my opinion has been sought or asked for, I've been able to give it. And I feel like the folks on the Horsemen's Advisory Group, as well as those that sort of monitor it from the safety committee, et cetera, I feel like I've been well received, and I don't know what's going to come of it, if anything, but they have made me feel welcome. And again, you know, all of the legal challenges and all of the ongoing inner workings of the National HBPA it's a monumental task, truly, and I don't know how they get it all done and do the everyday thing and then put this convention on, and all of that organizing is beyond me.
Out of curiosity, it occurs to me to ask the question, and I suppose I should ask Eric as well. Do you feel that the initiative has strengthened the HBPA or injured it?
Oh, no, I think it's brought a lot of us together, you know, and I think it's drawing people into the HBPA that maybe had grown distant, or that are currently members of other horsemen's groups that are showing interest again in the HBPA and standing with us, sometimes behind the scene, but certainly a lot of support from those other members, other horsemen from around the country that are members of other groups. So, yeah, strengthened us in general, but drawn people towards us as well.
And that's what I'm curious about. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of, you know, in terms of the affiliates and in fact, how it touch on, because I don't know if I've asked Eric this. Maybe he covered it at the beginning of the legal proceedings. Did the constituents vote on advancing a legal challenge? How or was the legal challenge basically mounted and you know how was that derived?
It was brought up and voted on and approved within our executive committee meeting.
Got it.
Way back. And certainly there, I have no doubt that there are HBPA members that aren't entirely in favor of the ongoing court challenge, but they are woefully outnumbered by the vast majority of our membership.
This is a question that, I mean, it'd be nice to have Eric and Alan Foreman on hand. You know, vis-a-vis THA's position,
mm-hmm.
and there's overlap. You know, we should mention, because Alan, you know, when Alan talks, and I go to him with Q&As on this, and of course his legal mind has, you know, an added unique perspective to the discussions. We frequently forget to mention that, you know, there's HBPAs that are involved in THA.
Mm-hmm.
There is overlap, including, I think, West Virginia, right?
Correct.
So
Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What and how active in your role have you been in trying to be prepared to work with those that want to install HISA, and how viable is it to, you know, get on board if and when, you know, the opportunity comes forward?
Well, I'm not going to begin to speak for Alan Foreman or Eric, but the, you know, the horsemen in general working together, none of us in either organization will deny the fact that the need for uniformity and the call for it has been there for quite some time, and we agree with 90% of what's proposed in HISA, but not with how they've gone about doing it and the implementation process and really, you know, who's paying for it. That's the biggest thing, and you know, the redundancy of tasks that is going to obviously be going to happen. And I think, what's the legal term for it? If Peter was here, you could tell me the commandeering of those employees from racing commissions. I think it's the implementation process that's the problem. And I think that when it all shakes out, we're all still horsemen, all on the same team, and all really want similar things. And we want the cheaters gone, and we want uniform rules, and we want uniform testing. And again, it's not the thought behind behind HISA. Again, it's the implementation, how they went about it. I feel like there was just I'm a small time horseman, and I think I like a small time horseman, and I don't like that there was a group. Clearly, there was a group of folks not like me that put this together, and that are now saying we're making the rules for everybody, and you're going to pay the bill.
One thing that I didn't broach actually with Daniel Schur and Peter Eckebert is the cost factor. And you know, we understand, I don't want to get too anecdotal, but you know, we understand that you mentioned commissions and mm-hmm. various operating arms mm-hmm. of state racing commissions, including essentially the test barn employees and things along those lines are being enjoined and approached and being offered, whether it's day rate or whatever the compensation packages are. And yet we still only have this, you know, laundry list of potential costs.
Right.
And that still has not been really finalized or specified mm-hmm. as to, you know, where this is coming from. I mean, right now, you know, there's certain, you know, as Satish famously called it, the alphabet soup organizations mm-hmm. are funding, you know, the underpinning.
Right.
But that'll only last so long before a bill is going to be dropped on the table. And one of the big concerns continues to be that horse players, first and foremost, are going to somehow be, you know, dragged into mm-hmm. having to pay because they, as part of their clandestine approval process, they managed to extricate the one protection that horse players had, which was delineated in earlier versions that takeout could not be used to pay for the implementation of an authority. They managed to extricate that, and you know, despite you know, trying to draw attention to it from our effort, then there's the owners who are already absolutely put upon in terms of expenses.
There's only so many sources for that money.
Exactly. And yeah. I mean, and owners, and then there's, to be honest, then there's the racetracks who are operating on razor thin, if any margin profitability. So it's concerning that we still at this what seemingly is a late date mm-hmm. don't know where that revenue, you know, where they're going to derive that revenue, and they have continued to not address it.
Well, you know, we've just recently seen a racetrack that has withdrawn from HISA and Wolf and voluntarily taken their signal down, and that's for those reasons. They don't know what it's going to cost, and instead
of talking Fonner,
correct. So instead of going into it blindly and saying, "Oh yeah, we'll do this, we'll just make it work," I think they're taking that cautious approach. And I think, you know, if you listen to what HISA is saying, they think they have a philosophical difference with the tracks that aren't participating, meaning Texas and Fonner, and clearly it is a monetary concern. It's not philosophical, and those horsemen would fight that opinion vehemently.
Dr. Doug Daniels with us, the president of the National HBPA. Before we wrap, Dr. Daniels, what as we convene here, aside from the elephant in the room, it's actually an entire pack of elephants. What are the most pressing issues that you feel are important to address with everyone here the next couple of days?
You know, one thing that that few people talk about and hasn't gotten much publicity is all the work that the HBPA does for the immigration bills, H-2B visas, et cetera. And we've truly spent a lot of time with our lobbyists in trying to make that a better thing for the horse industry and agriculture in general. And so that's something that just really has gotten very little publicity that still Eric spends a lot of time trying to get things done for our people.
The future then, what positive message can you proffer?
Well, I mean, I think the one thing, and I say it all the time, change is inevitable. I mean, and it's just a matter of what that change is going to be from a standpoint of regulation of our industry. And that's the biggest argument. It's not that change isn't coming or isn't necessary, but it's just how we go about it and doing it in a way that is the least abrasive to, especially to those folks that are going to pay for it. And so from an optimistic standpoint, I feel like it will ultimately bring horsemen together, but this is going to be a painful process in one way or another. And I think you'd agree with that, Steve. You know, it's again, we agree with most things, but to have this implemented with no funding attached to it is just, I mean, those folks that put this together, the high ups in our industry that feel like they have the wherewithal to push it upon us, I think they just assume we're going to pay it. And I think ultimately we will.
That's even acceptable to a degree,
mm-hmm.
under the condition that it's taxation with representation.
Well, and a purposeful downsizing of our industry. I think that's something that I think no one will deny. They realize that there are some small jurisdictions that will not survive this process, implementation and the funding of HISA. They won't survive. I mean, and again, that is a willful, purposeful, in my opinion, purposeful downsizing of our industry, and it's not right.
That we've made that point nonstop. Absolutely agree, and we brought it up over and over again. They would love to see a certain percentage of the game disappear, and it does, frankly, it that portion bewilders me when it comes to the support of certain commercial breeding operations. Do they not understand the ramifications of that?
I don't know what pressures they're under to make that happen, because clearly there's a trickle down effect to this, and it'll hit them too. Yeah, I don't know what pressures they're under from a standpoint of other organizations, and without naming names. And I feel like that has to be it. Because those same the offspring of their stallions and that go through the sales, and you know, they end up in the smaller jurisdictions,
of course,
and it offers a demand for those horses that will otherwise be gone. So I don't know. There's some piece of the puzzle that I don't understand. And my only explanation is that there's pressure being applied by other folks to get them to have that opinion.
Dr. Doug Daniels, National HPPA president. I always appreciate, and everyone does, the commitment to this and the time and effort that goes into it.
Appreciate being here. Thank you.
Dr. Daniels, everybody. And there's many portions of the way this has unfolded that are just bewildering. And we just we touched on a couple of them. We've got about 15 minutes to spend to the top of the hour. I promised a visit with Andy Serling. He's going to join us here, not physically. I don't know if Andy's ever been to. I think he told me once. I think I asked him one of these trips to New Orleans if he had ever been. I think he said he had. Got to get some reaction, and of course, Andy. Andy deserves tremendous tremendous praise for laying out the price winner of the Gotham. Andy, first of all, that's the first order of business. Well done.
No, did I pick the winner?
That you picked the exacta. Thanks. You laid out the exacta for everybody.
Thanks. I don't really want to sit here and say my phrases, but thanks.
Well, why not?
I'm supposed to pick winners occasionally.
Well, okay. Picking winners is one
thing. Steve, I just don't like doing it, but I appreciate it.
Okay, well, then please explain what you liked about Ray's cake.
No, I said it on Talking Horses.
Well, not
okay. Come on, there's better things to talk about than why I actually picked the winner.
Well, I all right.
You know I hate this.
I'm sorry you hate it, but people want to know the anatomy of sports.
If people want to know, they should listen to Talking Horses. I don't know what to tell you. There are reasons to pick winners. Sometimes your reasoning is sound and they run lousy most of the time. Sometimes your reasoning's good and they happen to win. I don't know. Maybe you really like the slop. I don't know. You just seemed like a horse that wanted more distance in a race that was wide open. He obviously was foolish to run him on a synthetic racetrack, and he'd run okay in his other races. I don't think his form was that bad if you dissected it. And it was a wide open big field and not a race where you're supposed to be looking to pick short priced horses. So I looked at horses that were probably a little off the beaten path, and he appealed to me for some reasons. You know, his race at Keeneland was better than it looked like. He clearly wanted to go farther. He didn't want to go 6 furlongs, and he'd run decent figures in those other races. I don't know what about his race behind that horse two back at Fairgrounds didn't make him a contender. I just think he was a playable horse. He drifted up. He's obviously much shorter priced than the exact is.
Right.
I hear you, but I just, it's like, I've been there, done that. You know, we've been through it. It's like.
I hear you. Well, this is the Tuesday, Tuesday hour.
Tuesday's not here to pat ourselves in the back for picking winners. Maybe other people want to do it. I know.
Stylistically, we know Slip Mahoney and Iron Clover Iron Clover definitely, it seems, is going short. What do you make of these horses potentially for the wood or other longer assignments?
Well, Iron Clover's obviously not going to run longer, but
right.
He actually ran a respectable race, considering. I don't know what made him a 3-1 favorite in the race, but he ran fine. It was a fast pace, and he didn't really fold. You know, he kind of blew second in the last 16th of a mile. I just got nipped for third. He ran fine. Probably, he arguably may have run the second best race in there. I don't know what to say about Slip Mahoney. You know, it's hard to really know how good he is. I mean, I know that the Todd Pledger horse that's running in the Tampa Bay Derby, unless the field has dramatically changed from the Sam Davis, he's obviously going to be a heavy, heavy favorite there. What's his name? Of course, the one, the allowance race, the same day as the Holy Bowl. That people are going Capit Trice.
Yeah, Capit Trice.
I thought he ran pretty well in that race. I don't think his last race was as good as the figure suggested. Slip Mahoney, you know, he rode a gold rail that day. I know he had a good trip, but Kruppi really has kind of demonstrated that he's not that good. He just happened to run big that day. Now, they didn't put a lot of distance to the other horses. How good that race was remains to be seen. But he wasn't the rail that day. I don't know what went wrong with the Gotham. You know, he broke a little slow, but then he just sort of plummeted in the back of the pack. And I don't think that's really the way that Trevor McCarthy rides. So it seemed like he sort of lost interest early. And, you know, he was wide, but he was also picking up pieces. And that was a very quick pace, very quick contentious pace. made even more so by the loose horse sort of rushing up into the middle of the race. So I thought he ran okay. I don't think he ran better than I and Clover. I just think that he's more likely to want a distance. But listen, I thought that Al Gold, who owns him, you know, said some very good things before the race, where he basically said, you know, there's a lot of horses better than him right now, and we're not thinking he's necessarily a Derby horse. See what you get from him, or some paraphrasing, or something to that effect. And I don't think that we have any. Instead of any way you come out of this race saying, oh, I think he's definitely a Derby horse, you go to the race saying, let's see what he does in the wood. I wouldn't be surprised to see him run okay in there. But as of now, I wouldn't be a big fan, but you don't really know. Races in a month and see who's in the race, et cetera, et cetera. But it's hard to be overly optimistic about him after that race, but I certainly wouldn't throw in the towel either. It's a long year. What? As far as the others, you know, the Baffert horse, that was Tim Yakin Baffert horse, you know, Cancel kind of eased him in the last, definitely eased him in the last eighth of a mile, but he was setting a very fast pace. I didn't see any others, you know, maybe some didn't hail the track, you know, I don't know, but didn't seem like anybody else did any real running in there, did it?
I mean,
General Banker picks up pieces, right?
Yes, that's what he does.
We talked about it on Talking Horses. You know, it's something that Nick had said to me the other day.
Yep.
General Banker, he's the kind of horse, and the kind of horse that's not going to do any significant running in the race until the late stages. And if you think there's going to be a fast pace, he always seems to show up with some kind of run. Maybe you get a piece, and he did. He just picked up
Clover, yeah. For his third, basically. Yeah, third straight graded stake placing for General Banker. Pretty cool.
Yeah, he's a nice little horse. I understand he's got Derby points. They're thinking Derby, and I get why Jimmy's excited, and why shouldn't he be? And listen, last year, look who won. But obviously, he's a long, long way from being even remotely fast enough. You know, I mean, you think about who's that silly horse that keeps getting entered at Oaklawn that was thrashed, and he's entered again on Saturday or something. That closer that people kept falling for was getting the perfect trips.
Barber Road.
Yeah, right. You know, he's not even as good as Barber Road. Barber Road wasn't a horse that belonged in the Derby either. But the Derby's always going to be full of horses that don't belong in it.
That's
usually
true.
Some version of 19 of them.
As
in most races, right?
Well, one thing about the Gotham that it was just heartening is the benefit of having a big field. It just we get so few these days that having a luxury of this kind of a group where horses, there's going to be prices available for people to to latch onto. That's what's fun.
Big fields are going to give you an opportunity to hunt around for prices. The problem with that is that most of the time you're still going to be wrong. You know, it's the idea of handicapping races is to find things that appeal to you and hope that occasionally it works out.
Exactly. Talk a little bit about the other two stakes, and we had the quote-unquote other Chad Brown, the Practical Joke. Practical Joke had an amazing day as a stallion. Little Vic, of course.
I heard he was really excited. I heard he was really happy.
He took everybody. He took all his pals out for straw, for hay.
She got the mile, and the rest of them didn't. I say that's what it came down to. She obviously improved her figure, about 15 points from her first two slow races. But, you know, she sort of got the distance, and probably the slower pace. It was probably a situation where they were, you know what I think about taking speed horses like the runner-up in their asset purchase and rating them in submission sort of on it, not using their speed as a weapon. Now, I don't really think she was getting the mile regardless. She opened up mid-stretch on the slow pace, and she just perceptibly tired late in what was a relatively slow race. I think Asperger's a good horse, but if she's going to have a stakes-winning year, it's probably going to be in 6 or 7 furlong dirt races, not mile and above races, because she still should have gotten it. But she was a little bit of a disappointment, especially considering she opened up in mid-stretch. Obviously, Zioretti was a massive disappointment, and the Bradcox horse didn't do a lot of running in there either. It was overall a slightly disappointing race because there were three horses that had potential to be okay, and none of them ran particularly well. and the winner improved. So it was good for her. Whether or not she continued to improve and improve more distance goes forward just remains to be seen. She's only run three times, so certainly is possible. And listen, she ran a 77 buyer. How far from being a contender at the Oaks is she at this point? We'll see what she does if she can get her step forward in the Gazelle. You know, I don't think anybody got scared by what happened down in the Devona Dale. So right now, the three-year-old filly division remains sort of in disarray. And maybe we'll get a better idea in a race like the, the Fantasy and the Ashland. I mean, that's, you know, at least at this point last year, we had seen the Secret Oath was going to be a player, and she's entered in a fun Azari against Clarier and, Interstate Daydream. But, this year, it's just a bunch of mostly slow horses. Doesn't mean there isn't time to step forward, but the three-year-old filly division, the colt division, there's enough horses that seem quick enough that it could get interesting at some point. The filly division right now, they got a lot of improving to do.
Andy, nobody's
stepping forward that I can tell.
Before I ask you about the Fountain and the San Anita, the San Felipe, Little Vic with a nice performance,
He was terrific. Yeah, he was really terrific. It's a huge effort. I'm not sure where it came from, but he ran huge. Yeah, it was a really good race. My son of a gun always runs well. You know, I mean, a lesson from that race to betters is don't bet horses like Nakatomi at short prices on the come, but that's a constant situation, right?
Well, and one thing about this, it was nice to have a real pace, too, you know?
Yeah, but don't forget, the winner and second horse sat third and fourth, so they both were close enough to pace.
That's true. That's true, because Pirate Rick... Well, actually, no, it wasn't Pirate Rick that set the pace. It was Chateau that set the pace.
Correct.
You go. And Pirate Rick was pressing, or trying to. This is, of course, Victor Martinez, the retired Major League Baseball player, catcher, and big win, paid $15. Andy, you got to run, so let me quickly get...
I got a few goods.
Okay, good. Forte, and then the big effort in California by Practical Move. Some thoughts about the big three-year-old preps outside.
I didn't watch the California race, so I probably should. I probably should do a better job of familiarizing myself with those horses because I haven't. I don't even know about that horse. He was bred by Sal Kuhlman and Chad Brown.
Pretty cool.
And they sold him a two-year-old sale. But you know, a Fort. I'm going to keep calling them Fort. That's who I am. But, you know, I was talking about him on Twitter Friday that he should be considered the Derby favorite. And I think some people have issues with that. And obviously now he is the Derby favorite. Whether or not he's the horse that's going to win the Derby, you know, I don't know. He's a really nice horse that's run really well in all of his races. It doesn't matter where he runs, what distance, what track condition. He shows up and runs and is an incredibly admirable horse. And right now, I think should be considered the favorite. But he's going to have to, at some point, run faster because Practical Move ran a 100 buyer. He got a 98. It's his first start of the year. So I'm not, you know, and I don't, you know, and Todd's goal will be to have him ready to run his big race on Derby Day. And, you know, people say, oh, Todd's disappointed so much in the Derby. I don't really know that that's true. I'm not sure that if you look at the entire, you know, body of work for us in the Derby, that he hasn't run to his odds or outrun his odds. He's run a lot of no-hopers in there. Every trainer in the game has massive disappointments in the Derby. Todd won two. People say, oh, it was wet tracks. He was lucky. Well, he may have been unlucky in some other races. You know what I mean? You're not really lucky to win two Derbies. So it doesn't bother me. I assume that Todd will have him ready. He always does. And he's a horse that always shows up. Whether or not he's that kind of horse that you're, you know, he's not making anybody get overly excited. He's a workmanlike, solid racehorse. He didn't beat a particularly good field on Saturday. But his first start of the year, he's had a perfect trip and he buried them. It's a really, really nice horse. It's a really reliable horse. Whether or not that's going to make him a horse you want to bet on a Derby Day, well, we'll figure that out in early May. You know, a lot of hand-wringing going on when there's no real reason to be, to have to worry about it. You know, you watch the preps, you see what he does next time, you see what the other horses do, and you find out where you are. But I think he has to because they're the horse to beat for the Derby right now.
Yeah, he's got, he's in terms of resume completion, he comes back with that kind of an effort, especially in light of so many coming, you know, not coming back and taking steps forward, at least in their first start, their first seasonal visits. You should watch, you get a chance, watch that San Felipe. I think you'll be impressed. With
that San Felipe as opposed to the other San Felipe?
Yes, yes.
Okay, I'll get right to work. Really gearing up for that.
I'm just the rest of that action at Gulfstream. You made a reference to the Devona Dale and the upset there by Michael Yates's Darth Vader.
I was 45-1. Not that I liked her. But...
Well, Mike Welch.
It should have been that race.
No,
Michael. Yeah, that was a goofy race. I mean, a very slow maiden breaker got second. I didn't pay that much attention, and I tend not to pay a lot of attention to the race to Gulfstream.
Well, Andy, I appreciate it, and wanted to get some thoughts in about the Gotham.
Thanks. Enjoy your big HBPA DA day today, right?
Today and tomorrow, and then off to Vegas for the NHC.
What time are you speaking? Today.
I'm right now, 9 to noon.
This is it for you. I do have to run. All
right, see you later. Andy Serling, everybody, and just between the three big preps, and not just the big preps, but all the supporting stakes that came with it. Like, of course, well, the big cap is not a supporting stake. The big cap itself, a standalone. We're going to take the time out here, top of hour two. Kelsey Danner, speaking of winners from the Gulfstream card, I absolutely was not missing a chance to get Kelsey to join us. We'll probably get to her in about 15 minutes because Doug Miller is here, and we'll get the other half. This has been one of those two half stories. You heard, of course, back at the time when Kid O'Dan won at Kentucky Downs, but we'll get the story from Doug and how it, what a fun experience it's been for the claiming horse of the year, Kid O'Dan, right? We'll relive that, really a fun, I was there, and it was interesting. We'll talk about how it came about, essentially. Tom Law.